Okay, our speaker is from Tucson. Please help me welcome Chris R. Right.
Hi, I'm Chris, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
And just a quick, how long do I speak? All right, I'll try to stop before I start lying. It's rough. Grateful to be here clean and sober. And my story, I thought a lot about this over the weekend. I knew when I've been asked to speak here, what a big deal it was to me to be at an Alcathon and share my experience, strength, and hope with you. So, you know, needless to say, I've gone over and over what this would feel like and what it would be like. And I've been reduced to what I'm always reduced to, is calling my sponsor going, help me transmit something, you know. God, give me something to transmit. I can't transmit what I don't have. And my sponsor did the same thing. He almost always does. Like, are you an alcoholic? I said, yes. Did you drink today? I said, no. And he goes, you're transmitting, baby. You know? And, well, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. What it was like for me is, I had a separation from God when I was about 9 years old. I was always a kid that would be the one burying small animals that died or got hit by cars. I wanted to be a priest. I was raised in a very religious family. And I used to perform ceremonies for small animals when I buried them and make little crosses. And one of those animals, at one time, I clearly remember having this conflict in my head about why and questioning life and existence itself. And on that day, I remember kind of saying, all right, that's it. I don't want anything more from you. I don't want anything from you. And I kind of divorced that whole idea inside somehow. And other things were going on in my life as a child to the point where it was the first night, and the reason I bring this up, it was the beginning of what I think is related to my alcoholism, who I am as a person. The first night that I pushed my head down into the couch covers and I wanted to be anything other than what I was. I would have traded anything to be and feel anything other than what I felt. And that went on through my life until I reached about the age of 13 and discovered beer. Once I had some beer and started drinking, something happened in my state of being, in how I looked at the world, and my approval, and my self-worth. And it was like magic for me. It just changed my entire existence. So through high school, I proceeded to try to drink as much as I could, as often as I could, to feel that way as often as I could. And my brother was a successful drinker, and I looked up and modeled his behavior. And pretty soon, early in high school, I was experiencing blackouts and delving into other substances and chemicals. Pretty much became a garbage pail alcoholic and drug addict that would put anything in my body that I could get that I think would, you know, give me a chance of feeling anything other than what I felt. And what happened? I kept getting worse and worse. My friends started dropping off faster and faster. My the class of people that I had hung out with started getting lower and lower. And pretty soon, I was a full-blown, powerless and hopeless, desperate alcoholic. By the time I realized that I needed to get sober, I think it was too late. In retrospect, I don't know. I'm not a doctor, but by the time I realized, if I don't quit drinking, I am definitely going to die, I couldn't quit drinking. My first AA meeting was when I was 17, and I went to get my mom and then girlfriend off my back. And I went in and I stood up in this room in Riverside, California, and I said, hi, my name's Chris. I might be an alcoholic, you know. And they all laughed. They were like, keep coming back, Chris, you know. And I was like, I congratulate you people with what you have here. You're doing a wonderful thing helping save alcoholics, and very good for you guys, you know, proceed. And I couldn't stay sober. I didn't even put two and two together. So as my drinking progressed, so did the bad things that happened in my life. And I learned how to rob and steal and betray people in my life. And basically, look, put it this way, the best way I could qualify my drinking and drug addiction was, if you were the last friend I had and I had burned everybody else out, I would steal your drugs and spend 2 hours helping you look for them. It didn't matter, you know? Like, I had to get messed up. I had to get drunk. I had to feel different. I had no other option. And so by that time, when I realized I had to get sober and still couldn't, kept trying, it was a life and death existence. No different than many of you have been through. But for me, it was like every morning I'd wake up, or when I'd come to, my eyes would open, and I'd be like, is this the day I'm going to die, or is this the day I'm going to get another bottle, or is this the day I'm going to try again? And sometimes I would try, and I'd go to AA, and I'd pick up a newcomer chip, and I'd come home and do whatever I could to not drink or use, and I'd get like 2-3 weeks sober, and, you know, the VCR clock was hard to set, so I'd go out. Or, you know, girlfriend broke with me, so I go out, you know. And I had the first DUI, got busted on suspended license, got the second DUI, and lost my license again, and was riding a bike, and was physically ill and hopeless. That's what it was like for me. By the end of my drinking and using, I was living at my father's house, only on his compassion and forgiveness. I was 20 years old. I had nothing to my name. I had ruined everything in my life. All my hope and prospects had been done. And I had cans and bottles and remnants of chemicals and drugs and the way I lived all around the room. And my mom, by then, had separated from my dad. And she was into this tough love type thing. And she's a special person. She was working as a psych nurse in a lockdown facility, and well, I've been locked down a few times against my will because of my actions in this disease. But by then, I tried to call out for her to help me, and she said, "Well, okay, all right. I needed $20 for gas, and I basically it was for some chemicals. And if you come to this meeting, you listen to this guy talk, I'll give you the $20 for gas." I said, "All right. I can handle it." And she took me to lunch, and she had this gentleman, this weird, freaky gentleman, sitting there at the table I'd never seen before in my life. And he proceeded to just talk while he cut his steak about how he drank and what he did with his life and how he ruined everybody else's life around him and all this story of his experience. And I sat there and I was like, wow, the most proudest, biggest, coolest thing about your life is that you don't drink? Mom, give me the money. Come on, you know? What is that? And I got the money and proceeded to keep turning and burning. And one day, I had a self-help book, and it said, if you're angry at somebody, roll up a newspaper and start whacking the chair and get your frustrations out with it. Self-help, you know. And I said, okay, I'll do it. All right, self-help. And I got a newspaper, and I started hitting the chair. And next thing I know, I like blacked out in like this rage of anger. I just started destroying the chair and throwing things and breaking things. It was just Tasmanian deviling out. I started hitting myself, I started hitting my girlfriends, I started hitting God, I started hitting every animal that ever died. I just had like this psychotic break about my entire life and my entire existence on that day. And I went down on my knees, and in blood and snot and tears, I said the first prayer I've ever really said since that day when I was 9. And I just asked for help. And I heard something inside me say, get up. And I got up, and I watched my hand go through this wreckage on the desk, and I pulled a business card out, and it was this man's number. And I called this number. I said, I want to get sober. Can you help me? And it's the first time I had ever asked another person for help, even though I had been in and out of these rooms for about 3 years. And he said, all right, where are you? And I told him I was in Riverside, California. And he said, meet me over at the Bob's Big Boy. And this man drove 3 hours in L.A. traffic to come talk to a strange kid he had nothing to gain from. And he sat down and he bought me breakfast. And he poured a bunch of syrup on the pancakes. And he proceeded to scare the living hell out of me with stories about people he had known, what this disease is, what's going to happen to you, Chris. You know, just nonchalant. Yep, and then you'll die. Have some more syrup. You know, because there's lots of sugar in the booze, and you've been training your body to, you know, work on that sugar. And I couldn't sit still. I was just completely certifiably insane and in fear of my life every second. And it seemed like years of facing death or suicide. And I was just so desperate and so hurt and so tired that I wanted to get sober. And the how many times I had tried to get sober, and in my opinion, it just didn't work. This thing doesn't work. I was just so desperate that I told him I was going to do whatever he said. And I was, like the big book has mentioned, I was as desperate as the dying can be. And he said, all right, we're going to go get you some candy bars. We're going to get you these numbers. We'll take you down to this meeting. And he proceeded to lay out this physical action step-by-step plan of what I was to do that day. And one of the things was, we don't drink or use no matter what. Say it with me. And I was like, we don't drink or use no matter what. You know, who... He goes, we don't drink or use no matter what. And I'm so grateful to God that my higher power put this man in my life, because at that time, that's pretty much all I could understand about your program. So we don't drink or use no matter what. So I hung on to my M&Ms, and I went home, and I called the 800 line that he promised me there was some lonely, sober person that dying to talk to you. Just call them. You know, if you feel the urge to get in your truck, just throw your keys over and hit your knees and call me. You know, and it was kind of like the step-by-step plan of action that my sponsor laid out. The third day I was sober, I got up and completely psycho from the sheer amount of chemicals I had been putting in my body. I had been watching spiritual messages from the other worlds and all this other, you know, my brain was just fried. I had put so many chemicals and so much constant vodka and booze in my body that I was physically and mentally incapable of really thinking. But I was driving a truck on a suspended third DUI and watching the billboards talk to me. And I remember going into this stop and go thing, and I looked up and they had a lottery, last chance to redeem, 25th. And it was March 25th, the third day I was sober. Now, I hadn't taken any drugs in my body. I hadn't drank one beer. But my body was not sober. My mind was so destroyed. And I looked at that and it said, last chance to redeem. And everything just kind of, oh. I thought that this was God saying, all right, that's it. It's time to go. Either live or die. And it's all about today. My grandmother died 3 months before then on the 25th. And for some reason, I was like, that's it. So I got in my car and I'm going down to the group that I had been going to and exchanging newcomer chips after newcomer chips, because that was like this big honorable thing I used to do when I relapse. I come in and say, hey everybody, I need a new one of these. I'm making a recommitment, you know. And this time I was in my truck. I had my hand on my newcomer chip because I could stay in the lane when my hand was on my newcomer chip. My big book was on the floorboard and I had my seatbelt, and I was behind a city bus, and I looked at that bus and I thought, 25th, last chance to redeem. God and the devil been fighting over my valuable soul all day, and it was going to happen. Something was going to happen. All right, so I'm going to push the pedal down and I will fly through this bus. God is going to make a miracle of me, and it's going to be a testament that everybody in the world should stay sober. Or I'll die and instantly be in front of God, and I'll be able to be like, why'd you kill them small animals? You know? And I floored my truck with no fear in my mind. I got up third gear up to about 85, and I hit that bus. You can't see it on tape, but there's a football scar on me where I ruptured my intestines and a bunch of other internal organs and was bleeding and all that. I injured 7 people on that bus that walked out of the hospital that day. The truck was folded. There used to be a truck by Arizona, the Tucson International Airport, that was an example of what happens when you drunk drive. And my father had said that, yeah, that your truck was worse than that one. And the guy that came picked up the truck later said, anybody live? And the guy said, yeah, the driver. And he's like, the driver, you know? That's where my drinking and using led me, and that's what happened. That's what it was like. On the helicopter, I had one of my out-of-body experiences, and I believe my higher power visited me and asked me whether I want to stay or go, and it was an experience that had no judgment in it. It was just like, stay, go, it all happened in a second, and I said, I couldn't feel my hands or anything. I just said, God, because I truly wanted to live. And as soon as I said God, I could all of a sudden heal a helicopter. I could all of a sudden feel the pain in my body. And all of a sudden I felt like I was in my body. And then I passed back out. I woke up like 5 days later. And that man that was at that dinner table was sitting there reading a Time magazine. And I had tubes all over my body. And he looked over and he's like, you want to get serious about sobriety yet? I was psychotic. I was hopeless, I was helpless, and that was the best of my thinking. That's as far as I went in my life by myself as an alcoholic. And I was scared. I didn't know what to think about, you know, anything. And I asked him, I remember saying, Jeff, what if I'm like a murderer? And he flipped the page and he was like, you'll be a sober murderer. I was like, Jeff, what if I'm gay? He goes, you'll be a sober homosexual. You know? Everything I kept talking, he would just answer with, we don't drink or use no matter what. Flatly. And there was a calmness in this and a peace in this man that just wasn't flappable. And went from there to a sober living house. Moved out of that sober living house after working on the first two steps. Started working on my fourth step on my third sober living house where there was no drugs or chemicals, which I almost, from my experience, highly recommend to anybody facing sobriety, is to not be around the physical substance. That's a kind of a plus, especially for someone like me. And I was working on my fourth step with this man and writing it out and doing all this stuff, and I was still just as crazy as I've ever been. And I remember one night my friend who I was living there bragged about his uncle that used to go watch UFOs. I was like, UFOs? He said, yeah, they go out to Groom Lake and they watch them with their camera. Here's the tape of it. And I'm watching this tape and I'm looking at this light thing and I'm just, in my brain, I'm just, oh my God, there's UFOs? There's aliens? You know? And so that's what my world was, and I freaked out and I called my sponsor. And my sponsor came by after he got off work. And he says, what's wrong? And he pulled me outside. I'm like, I saw a tape and there's aliens and they're going to invade us and my whole world's over. And he said, calm down, calm down. All right, Chris, number one, we've gone over this, that there is a God, there's something other than you. There's a higher power, right? I said, yes. He goes, okay, well, what if UFOs exist? And I was like, oh, he goes, no, no, no. Number three, the most important thing, if God wants you to have anything to do with an alien or a UFO, He'll put one in your life. Until then, tie your shoes, finish your fourth step, and get a job. And I remember, you know, for me, that's what happened. That's how I was doing my steps, and that's the stage I was at. That's where I was in my life. That was the best of my thinking. But I was willing to do what he said because there was just no other way. You know, we don't drink or use no matter what. I got through my fourth step, and I took a fifth step with this man. And he used to take me around to meetings and introduce me to all the people he knew. And he used to make his home group, the people like raise their hand up and say, all right, everybody, anybody who's relapsed recently, if you wouldn't mind, just go ahead and raise your hand. They'd all raise their hands. And he said, watch this. Now, out of all the people that have relapsed, how many of you have finished your fifth step? And the hands would just drop. And he'd be like nudging me, like pay attention, you know, because you have to do all the steps to really get to this thing. And I walked up on pure faith of what this man's life was like and how happy he was, how successful he was, in my opinion. I walked up a hill with him outside, and we cracked open that fifth step and pulled it out and shared. And it was one of the most scariest things to me at the time. But at the same time, how scary it was to be brutally honest with another human being at that moment, faced with my options, faced with the bust, faced with getting to a place that was certain I was going to kill myself again or try or whatever. It was a no-brainer at that time. And I think that's because I was just beaten into willingness. You know, my actions had led me there. I came off that mountain with an entire new view of my world, with an entire another level of existence. For the first time, and it sounds a little corny, but for the first time in my life, I was breathing easy. It felt like a diesel truck was been removed from my soul. And that's my experience with that fifth step. The first one, you know, and I went in through the sixth and seventh in a sober living house at 6 months in Pasadena, California. And he used to come and visit me, and they had meetings. And there were people there that would lead these home group meetings of people that had gone on in sobriety, and they all had their cups and their birthday, their date of sobriety on the wall. And I'd look up at those cups, and those cups, they had a year sober. And I was like, oh my God. And there were people that come back and speak on steak and dinner night, and there were guys that had 25 years of sobriety. And I was like, whoa. And these guys had some nice cars. These guys had like real clothes and jobs. And they were laughing, and it was just like blowing my mind. When this man that was my first sponsor met me, I have to qualify again and say, I could not write my own name. I couldn't write my name. I couldn't hold a job. I couldn't breathe. My life was absolutely of no intrinsic value. And going through that sober living house, having him, knowing that he had been preparing my mother to bury me while I was in ICU, those experiences, it just, that's what it was like for me. He took me to my first year of sobriety. I got sober on March 22nd, 1992. And on March 22nd, 1993, he took me on another cakewalk, he would say. And he said, look, we're going to go to as many meetings as we can find that give a chip out. And we're going to go and take your chip, and then we're getting in the car and we're splitting. And the idea is we're going to show as many people as we can that this crazy, sick, you know, expletive referring to me, if you can stay sober, anybody can, you know. And that's what we did, and we took our chips, and the biggest meeting we had was a street, and he said, I'd like to present Chris this, you know, this year, congratulations. And he told the whole crowd, he said, the party's over, Chris, now it's time to work. That first year was for you, you know, congratulations. Everybody clapped, and he leaned in when he handed me my chip. He leaned in and he said, the party just started. Since then, the party just started. That's what he whispered in my ear. He didn't tell the other people. He said, I'm just kidding. The party just started. You just got here. And I had been through the 12 steps at that point to the best of my ability, working with him every day, going to meetings, as many meetings as I could. And my life was already 5 times better than it had ever been in the world, and I had been writing my name successfully. I moved to Tucson about a year and a half after that, against his suggestions. I moved out here, and I had always, aside from wanting to be a priest and a veterinarian, I wanted to be a drummer. I wanted to be a musician. And after that fifth step, when we were talking, he also told me, he said, you need to take a paper out and write down the life of your dreams, your most wildest imaginations. And I want you to put anything on there. You can put anything you want. What do you really want? And I was like, I want to be a musician, you know, a real musician, and I want to play the drums, and I want to get paid money for it. I want to have my own car, and I want, you know, and these, to me at that time, were these extravagant lifestyles of the rich and famous dreams. To be a professional musician was like the coolest thing I could ever even think of at that time, my sobriety. And I wrote that down. And he said, all right, and he folded it up and put it in an envelope, and he said, I guarantee you, you shorted yourself. You just shorted yourself. Because within 5 years, it's going to be better than that, you know? And that's what I'm also grateful for, is the stuff that's not in the big book that can only be transmitted by other people that have lived it in this program. And that's what I guess I'd really like to also add on. If you don't have a sponsor at this point, you need to get one. You need to find somebody that is you can relate to when they share, and that you can call outside the meetings and just be honest with and ask honest questions about the program. Because if there is no wrong question, there's no stupid question. It's much better to embarrass yourself for what you would say, embarrass yourself, and get some type of answer for an honest question, than it is to be silent about it and screw something up and miss something and then use that for an excuse to not go to a meeting or whatever. So, you know, I got in the habit early of just go ahead and let my mouth open wide when I was talking to my sponsor and just bring up anything at all. And, you know, his experience, strength, and hope guided me in that first year. When I got out to Arizona, I started hitting meetings out here, and I got another sponsor locally. And I was working as a part-time parts driver and struggling, and I had gotten in a band, and I was able to actually hold a drumstick, and I started playing music again, and it was like this one miracle after another in my mind, because all I could think about was back in the day where I couldn't even hold a drumstick, let alone write my name, and here I am playing, and I'm working, and I'm doing this, and my life kept progressing and getting better. And then my life got worse. I fell in love, and I got in a relationship, and everything went to hell, and I thought, my whole life is over. I've got 3 years of sobriety, and there's no reason to live anymore, and I'm completely miserable. And all of it was, you know, right back to where I was with that thinking. Now, the difference is, I've been as low almost as I was at my bottom in sobriety in that example, in that case, but I didn't drink. we don't drink or use no matter what. And the horrible pain was there. The incomprehensible self-demoralization was still there. And I was working with a sponsor fervently and clinging to my friends and crying and curled up in a ball trying to be all dramatic or whatever you want to call it. But I was unhappy and miserable in my life in sobriety at 3 years. And I talked to the sponsor and I was honest with how my feelings were, and I told him where I was, and I asked for help, and my sponsor helped me, and we worked the steps, and then next thing you know, little by little, I started getting back into the solution and back into what I was supposed to have been doing anyway, and my life immediately just started miraculously getting better again. And I would go to the meetings and I'd see people that come in and out, and I was just like, wow, I could have drank. I'm so glad I didn't. And then at 4 years, I'd see somebody that came in, and right before they had 4 years, they had relapsed. Boy, it's great to see you, Chris. And I'd be like, oh, thank you, God, I'm still sober. Well, I should go to another meeting. This is a good thing. And my life kept getting better and better. And I sponsored people. And I used to take them to the meetings, and I'd ask people, my friends, to raise their hands and just be honest, out of the ones that relapsed. Out of everybody who relapsed here, who finished their fifth step and the hands would drop? And I'd be like, see, there's something to it. I don't know. I'm not an authority. All I am is an alcoholic who doesn't have to drink today by the grace of a higher power. But I do know there's something to completing all the steps. That is where I really, really started experiencing the change in my life. And what it's like now is I still go through those problems. I still have those same mental breakdowns and self-doubt from time to time. But I'm doing great, you know. I'm writing down stuff for me for 5 years from now, hoping I'm shorting myself again, because I can't explain to you how much better my life is. I'm sure that you guys here in this room know, but anybody listening to this, I really want you to just get to hear me say that again, because it's the truth. It's documented fact. I was locked up against my will in a psycho ward. Strapped down to beds, I've sliced my arm open in big displays of suicide and grandiose whatever because I was sick, because I drank and used and I couldn't stop. And I've come from that place where I couldn't hold a job, I could not not drink, I could not not use drugs, I could not not lie and cheat and steal my best friends and my family members. I've gone from that place to not only playing drums but being a full-time professional musician. I've toured the world. I forget to look at that sometimes, because when I think about when I got here, I think about how fantastic that dream was and how over the top it was for me to write that down on the paper and how awesome it was that I had a sponsor that didn't even blink when he saw it and he said, you can do that and more. No problem. We don't drink or use no matter what. I said, Jeff, do you think I could be a drummer? And he flipped the page in the ICU where I said, be a sober drummer. You know? I went from not being able to write my name or hold a drumstick to being with a drumstick company that makes sticks with my name on them and sells them to people. Not only that, I'm with my second company because the first one went out of business and I signed with another one. I've made an instructional video that's currently a bestseller. For what I do in my life, I'm represented by 5 worldwide companies with products related to what I do for a living. With like grown-ups with real jobs and real cars and real lives. I have so much in my life. And my message is, we don't drink or use no matter what. My father passed away this March. And it was really heavy for me because that first day of my sobriety, and I said he was letting me stay there out of compassion, I jumped up and embraced him at that point, and I looked in his eyes, and this man didn't understand. My father never really understood the pain. Few of our family members could really understand what this disease is and what it does. But he looked in my eyes and patted my back and said, it's okay. It's going to be okay. On that first, well, the 25th of March, 1992. And on the 26th of March, this year, he passed away suddenly. And as an alcoholic, before my knees hit the ground, hearing the news in the morning on the phone in Dallas, Texas, I hit my knees. Before I even hit my knees, I was judging myself for being a drama queen and overreacting about my father's death. So I'm one of you. I am right where I belong. You know? I'm right where I belong. I didn't drink. There have been times since my father's passing that I have wanted to drink. There have been times that I wanted to drink and use. And some people in this program I hear and I believe them. They're truth. But my truth is, personally, I have found it necessary to drink and use in 18 years, and I didn't do it. Because we don't drink and use no matter what. And as soon as I was honest enough to open the door, reach out and call or hit a meeting, that feeling had vanished. But that feeling has been there in my life. The obsession has been completely removed, but I'm telling you, in moments of great stress in my life in sobriety, I have considered drinking and using. I'm grateful that I didn't. I don't know what that secret is or why some people end up with 25, 30 years and some people don't. But I can tell you it has something to do with going to a meeting, not drinking between meetings, having a sponsor, reading the big book like you already know, and doing the steps. There is a magic formula there where if I haven't had all those aspects, I don't know if I could say I'd be sober right now today. You know, again, because my life is awesome. You know? And I don't know. I'm just so grateful that I got asked to speak here. I want to tell you that the power you guys have of being an alcoholic yet being sober, don't ever underestimate how powerful this is. And it's very important to look at yourself and judge yourself in that way and work through and be honest in it. But it's also important to get out of the rooms and chase the dreams you had before your life was halted by this disease. My experience only, my opinion. If I couldn't go out and do the life I had dreamt of, then what's the point? And I love coming to meetings and I love sharing my experience. But I also love living life. I love not wanting to kill myself. I love looking in the mirror and being happy with where I am. I love having problems that some of these normie people complain about. I love that. Oh man, the electric bill. And every now and then I'm like, they sent me a bill like a grown-up, like a real member of society. I got registration and insurance on my car. The cop lit his lights up behind me and I held my chip and I said, bring it. Which in earlier sobriety, I was a little mean. You know, I was a little kind of stupid. In earlier sobriety, around 5 years of sobriety, I'd go look and try to get cops to pull me over. You know, so I could be like, yeah, what, you know, whatever. I've since learned that the best thing to say to an officer is the answer, correct answer to whatever he asks you. Been drinking tonight? No. I've told cops my story. They're not interested in that. That's, again, just a part of me because, you know, there's still a part of me sometimes that thinks, hey, because I don't drink and use, y'all owe me something, you know? You lucky I'm not smoking crack today! And the truth is, I'm lucky I'm not smoking crack today. This is a privilege and an honor for me to be here. I can't do you justice as far as explaining how great this thing is. When anyone reaches out for help anywhere, I want the hand of AA to be there. I feel responsible. And when their hand is reached out, I reach back out. And from time to time, on my worst days sober, I have followed the advice of working with another and dropping pretty much everything in my professional, daily, obsessed brain to go run and just find somebody that's got a week and sit next to him. Because that's really where my solution still stays, you know. Newcomers are the lifeblood of this program, but I could also leave you with some quick advice from my experience in my path. And the first advice is, don't drink no matter what today. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous and you're wondering what the whole thing is, the first and most important thing is not to drink right now. Try not to drink until you get through the first meeting you get to. And before the meeting's over, find somebody that you relate to and make a commitment to yourself to reach out and ask them for help. Anyone in AA who has sincerely asked for help will give you that help. especially if you're afraid, especially if you think you don't belong. It doesn't matter. Don't drink first. Because you can have all the knowledge in the world and you can know all the steps and you can still end up drunk. It doesn't work if you drink. So don't drink. We don't drink or use no matter what. Second thing is, go to meetings. Like I said, reach out. Ask for help. And the other thing is, do the steps. If you don't have physical sobriety first, you don't have a shot at this. I never had a shot at it. The only solution came for me is when I put together over 33 days in a row and really started to breathe. And I feel like crying right now because I know people might be listening to this that never met us or whatever, that might be new and suffering right now. Because I can't explain to you how much your life is going to change within that first year and how unfair it is to judge this program within the first year or the first five. I didn't truly start experiencing what all these old timers were talking about until it was like 7 years I started really getting to what I thought, wow, no way. And the whole time I've had a solution. So if you drink, you're guaranteed not to have a solution. If you don't drink and you still screw everything up, as long as you don't drink or put chemicals in your body, you still have a shot. You know, you still have a chance at your dreams. And I don't know, because of a God greater than me, a higher power in my life, and people in this program, I'm alive and breathing today. And I'm very grateful. It's an honor for me to talk in front of you guys. And anybody listening to this that's in pain, I hope and wish and pray that you will have enough pain and suffering to bring you to a point where you're ready to change, where you're ready to reach out, and remember, be honest. There are people here waiting to help you. The number in the phone book with AA, they're waiting to talk to you. And there's a solution waiting for you. I've been in Amsterdam in an AA meeting, and they were talking this funky language, and I was scared, but you know, the fact that the AA symbols were there made me feel sober. And then it came around to me, and they looked at me, and they said, "Hi, I'm Chris, I'm alcoholic." And all of a sudden they said, "Hi, Chris," and the rest of the meeting was English. Yeah. I've been in meetings all over the world. We're all over. Been meetings all through U.S., Canada, Mexico. There are sober people all over. And Alcoholics Anonymous was not a prison sentence for me, and it hasn't been. It's been my source of freedom. It's been my chance at the life I always dreamed of. And I'm just so grateful to you people. Thank you so much for letting me share.
Thank you, Chris. I'm here to read the Declaration of Unity. Help me welcome Katie.
I'm Katie and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Katie.
The Declaration of Unity. This we owe to AA's future, to place our common welfare first, to keep our fellowship united, for on AA unity depends our lives and the lives of those who come. Thank you.